Does that mean you're moving to the middle, Gerard?
Oh, jeez. This one is not bad, but she says it's fine.
Quick, let me bring that.
Yeah,
that's what I hell.
My care. What would be great is you just have the terminals.
Yeah, just have it. Just plug in.
Yeah.
I was thinking about it again.
We're not talking. Just have something right there. The screen.
We're going to open our Rules Committee today, the 8th of February. And to begin with, we're going to open a work session for the introduction of committee bills.
Chair Rutland.
Representative Berger.
I move that LC 241, dated 2-8-2010, be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Berger moves that LC 241, dated 0208-2010, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is somewhat of a surprise and seems to be almost an exact copy of a Senate bill. Do we really know the reason behind this bill?
I have been given as much notice as you that this was coming to us today, and I think there have been a couple others that have come that way as well. And so my thing is to introduce it and then decide where it's going to get sent. It'll be sent probably back here, since this is the only place it can come back to, and then we can have a conversation about it. But I don't know any other.
Thank you.
First-hand knowledge of that. Any other discussion? Further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the introduction? And again, as I've always stated, when we introduce a committee bill, it does not mean that you're in favor or opposed to that bill. It just means that it's going to get introduced so that an introduction so that it can be then sent to a committee to be worked on. So with that, seeing no opposition to the introduction, it is so ordered. And we will close the work session on introduction of bills. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3700. It's a little out of order, but noting who is here, we figured we could do that one at the beginning, and then we'll go to our other two bills after that. So, again, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3700. And with that, we'll have a short introduction of the bill by our administrator.
Members of the committee, this measure permits credit unions to receive deposits of public funds on a basis similar to that of banks. It allows a state treasurer to accept monies, continuously appropriates monies to the state treasurer for initial expenses, and is effective on passage. There was also a -1 amendment that was distributed that requires the state treasurer to request repeal of provisions allowing credit unions to receive public funds deposits if a minimum number are not participating or if funding is not sufficient for administration.
So we are going to call up then first Pam Levitt, Hal, is it Skokins?
Scoggins,
thank you, Hal, and Ron Barrett. And I think what we'll do is have each person give their testimony and then we'll get questions from the whole panel, so we can keep it going. So with that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 3700. This is a bill to allow credit unions to accept public deposits from public entities over the current limit. This is an issue that I've been working on ever since I've been in this building, and I just celebrated 15 years with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. Public deposits are public funds deposited into a financial institution by a treasurer or a local government unit. We believe increased competition for public deposits is a good idea and arguably can provide better rates of return for public entities that invest with financial institutions. Examples of these public entities are listed in my testimony. Examples include public utility districts, fire districts, water districts, school districts. In 2003, credit unions were not allowed to accept any public deposits. A bill was passed in the 2003 legislative session that allowed us to accept funds up to the federal deposit insured level. At that time, it was $100,000. With the increase in the current federal deposit insured limits of $250,000, which does expire I believe in 2013. But the current level is $250,000 for deposits in credit unions. We have learned from public entities over the years that the $250,000 is really such a low amount that it's not really an issue for a lot of them to choose a credit union as their financial institution. Because of the way that the accounts happen, the transactional nature of these accounts, $250,000, if you say, for example, if you have a $1 million deposit, doesn't work in working with a credit union. And so we truly believe that credit unions are a good, safe, and sound option for these entities, and that is why we've been working on this bill for so many years. We believed increased competition for public funds would produce better rates of return for public dollars. Federally insured local credit unions would provide an additional option in the marketplace to deposit these deposit accounts. We believe it would be beneficial to local communities because credit union deposits reside locally in their locally owned cooperatives that are headquartered and make loans in the community in which they operate. There are over 4,000 public agencies in Oregon that receive public funds and require the services of financial institutions that house those funds. It seems like having credit unions as an option for them to look at is good public policy. In my testimony, you will see a number of issues and background on the tax-exempt issue of credit unions. That's something that we're hearing when we meet with a lot of members about why are credit unions tax exempt. So I thought I would remind you why in 1934 Congress passed the Federal Credit Union Act, and states around the country followed. Credit unions are not-for-profit financial cooperatives organized to solely meet the needs of our members. We're democratically owned and controlled institutions. We're governed by our members. We have volunteer unpaid boards of directors, and those volunteer boards of directors establish the policy credit union. I provided you with a number of additional issues. I'm not going to read my testimony, but I do want to say that on the taxation issue, credit unions do pay all different kinds of taxes, including property taxes and employment taxes. We are income tax exempt because we're structured as not-for-profit cooperatives, and that's the basic argument. Congress reaffirmed that in 1998. It's not based on what kinds of products and services you offer as a credit union. It's based on the not-for-profit structure. The bottom line, we are hearing and have heard from public entities and local communities all over Oregon for several years. I can provide you lots of anecdotal stories, and our members can tell you. I provided an example in Tillamook County from one of our local credit unions who sent me a letter this week, or sent their legislator. But they're coming and asking, we'd like to have a relationship. And this restriction, this law, has certainly been an impediment in building those relationships over the years. And this bill does not require any public entity to deposit in credit union. It gives them the opportunity, the choice for a local financial institution option. I have our attorney who's going to go over the bill, and one of our credit union CEOs who will talk about it from a credit union perspective. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney with Farley, Wada, and Witt in Portland. We represent many credit unions in Oregon and Washington, and we also are the outside counsel for the Credit Union Association of Oregon. And I'm here to run down some of the technical issues related to the bill and to answer any questions you may have. As Pam said, this is an issue that's been in the works for quite some time, a number of years, and we actually had a bill out last session that would do essentially what this bill does, which is put credit unions on an equal footing with the banks in terms of the opportunity for public funds deposits. Last session, the treasurer and the banks both felt like the law needed to be overhauled substantially from what it was, and you know, we didn't want to be mixed up in that process. They didn't want us mixed up in that process, and so we said, okay, let's delay until that's settled down a little bit, and so here we are. Chapter 295 was revised substantially, and the process for collateralizing public funds was revised substantially last session, and now that that's been done, here we are. The the whole point, of course, of this chapter is that public funds need to be safe and secure, and there needs to be a guarantee that money that's put into institutions will come out of institutions when it's public money. And that's what the collateral program is all about, and that's what this ORS Chapter 295 is all about. And it essentially provides for institutions to put up collateral for deposits that public entities make into those institutions. And the treasurer sets the amount of collateral based on the capital level of the institution and based on other factors the credit the treasurer believes might be appropriate in terms of evaluating risk of the institution. The institution puts up collateral with the custodian and then is able to accept public funds deposits based on the amount of collateral that's put up. What this bill would do very simply is put the same mechanism into place for credit unions that is currently in place for banks. And it would say any credit union that wants to accept public funds above the federally insured amount has to put up collateral, appropriate collateral, to secure those public funds and go through the process with the state treasurer and get approved to accept public funds. Once the collateral is there and the approval is granted, then the credit union could accept public funds on the same in the same manner as banks currently do. The sort of unique thing is that banks right now essentially secure each other's public funds. Each bank's collateral can be liable not just for its own public funds deposits in that bank, but also if another bank fails up to a certain percentage of what the bank has put in for collateral can be used to repay deposits that are placed with other banks that may fail. The same thing would be in place for credit unions, but credit union funds would or collateral would secure credit union public deposits, and bank collateral would secure bank public funds deposits. And this seems to be the way that everybody would be more happy with it working, including the treasurer, the credit unions, and the banks. So what this bill does, very simply, as I said, is put credit unions into the same sort of mechanism that is currently there for banks. It also does some things that deal with startup issues that would be involved in the startup of the program, because at first you're going to have a few credit unions getting in, and it'll take some time to get the momentum and the size, the number of credit unions into the program that would provide the ultimate type of security that comes with having large numbers of participants. So one thing it would do is it would say we're going to delay the start of the program until there are at least five credit unions that are ready and able to participate, that have public entities that want to deposit funds with them, and also that the funds for administering the program, which come from the participants. Right now, the bank program is administered by charges that are assessed against banks. Same thing would be in place for credit unions, but this would say the treasurer doesn't have to spend a dime until the credit unions are both ready and able to participate, but also that they've actually put up the funds that are necessary to operate the program for the first fiscal period. And then the second thing it would do is say, while there are less than 10 credit unions in the pool, then the current limit on each credit union's liability for another credit union's public funds deposits in the event of a failure, right now in the bank pool that is 10%, and ultimately in the credit union pool it would be 10%. But what this bill would do is say that the treasurer has the option to increase that liability to 20% while there are less than 10 credit unions participating. And again, the idea is just to maximize the security that is there for public funds deposits in credit unions. And then finally, something that the treasurer wanted and we were more than happy to agree to it, is that if there are less than five credit union participants for a period of more than 6 months, then the treasurer can simply suspend the program and not administer public funds deposits for credit unions anymore, and credit unions that are in the program at that point would then have to get out. In other words, it's saying if there's not enough interest among credit unions to actually make it worthwhile, then we're going to stop. We're confident that is not going to be the case, and that's why we're here before you today. As Pam said, this doesn't require any credit union to accept public funds deposits. Again, our membership is telling us that there is enough interest there to make it worthwhile. It doesn't require any public entity to place public funds deposits with credit unions, but what it does is create that opportunity. And may hear from some people on the banker side that, you know, it's not going to be economically viable. It's not a good idea for credit unions to get in. That's something that the credit union management is adequately equipped to make a decision on for themselves. And of course, credit unions are regulated by the same entity that regulates banks, and the DCBS is not interested in letting credit unions get into this if it's not something that's safe and sound. So they'll be looking over the shoulder of credit unions that participate, just as they do of banks. So that's what it's all about. It's about creating the opportunity for public funds deposits in credit unions, not requiring any public funds deposits in credit unions. I read in the paper a couple of weeks ago that former Secretary of State Bradbury was advocating having an Oregon bank, chartering an Oregon bank by the government to take Oregon public funds and loan them out to local small businesses. You know, this is something that would achieve a similar purpose without the state actually going to the trouble of chartering its own bank. So that's what the bill is all about, and now I'll turn it over to Ron Barrett.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ron Barrick. I'm President and CEO of Advantage Credit Union. We're headquartered in Milwaukee, Oregon, and we currently serve over 41,000 members in the primarily in the Portland metropolitan area. I'm here today to request your support of House Bill 3700, the Speaker of the House, House leadership, and State Treasurer's initiative to provide more deposit options for public entities throughout the state. The bill is really pretty straightforward, as Hal described. It would allow public entities to deposit their funds in Oregon credit unions above the current $250,000 insured limit. As Pam mentioned, the Oregon legislature passed a bill in 2003 that allowed public entities to make deposits in credit unions but cap the amount at the then insured limit of $100,000. However, even today's limit of $250,000 is so restrictive that it effectively eliminates credit unions as a depository option for even the smallest of public entities. We really believe this is a free market issue. I'm sure you're aware credit unions are locally owned by their members, controlled by volunteer boards of directors, and they're chosen from the membership. And we think local public entities should have the option of using the services of their locally owned credit unions. Credit unions throughout Oregon regularly receive service requests, as Advantis has numerous times over the years, from public officials in their communities. Some of the groups that we've heard from include public, local public utility districts, rural fire districts, city fire and police departments, school districts, city and county governments, etc. And the reasons we often hear that people would like to work with us include credit unions are locally owned and operated financial institutions. In fact, in certain parts of the state, credit unions are really the only financial institution option for some public entities. They personally know our volunteer board of directors and supervisory committee members, and they know their deposits are going to be used to provide loans to members in their local community. Other reasons include the longstanding commitment of credit unions to community service and involvement because it's the right thing to do, not because of federal mandates. Credit unions have a long history of providing free services to nonprofit organizations. Credit unions work with local school systems and senior centers in providing financial education. And also because we have a history of serving them as consumers, employees of these organizations know and trust us. We also believe passage of this legislation is good public policy for a number of reasons. One is it fulfills the request of the numerous public entities I've just described for more options with whom they can do business. Additional options naturally create more competition for public deposits. The additional competition is going to lead to better rates of returns on deposits, regardless of whether or not the public entity elects to actually expand or change their account relationship. In other words, and this is a critical point, just the presence of credit unions in this marketplace will increase the rates of returns on public deposits, regardless of whether or not any public entity chooses to use a credit union, and it's purely their choice. It also reduces exposure to the state treasurer's office by spreading the risk of public deposits over a greater number of financial institutions, so that's a positive. And also, we're not breaking any new ground here. This same model has been proven. It's already in effect in 19 other states in the country, including California, Idaho, Arizona, Hawaii, Montana, Nevada, to name a few. So this is not a new concept or approach to public deposits. In summary, public entities would like the option of being able to place their deposits with locally owned and controlled credit unions. However, the existing $250,000 cap on the amount that they can place is simply too low to allow for efficient investment management, and essentially it eliminates credit unions as a viable option. It makes sense for credit unions to be allowed to meet the service requests of the public entities within their field of membership, and it's also good public policy to do so. For these reasons, we respectfully request that you support the leadership's and state treasurer's initiative and adopt this common sense proposal to remove the existing cap. Local public entities throughout the state will benefit and would appreciate your support of House Bill 3700. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to testify.
So any questions for this panel?
We'll start all the way down at the end. Since he took your place, you know, we just Representative Garrett.
Thank you. Mr. Scoggins had a question regarding your testimony. The last page of your testimony, your written testimony, says that you refer to some federal and state regulations that limit the amount of public funds a credit union can accept. The second to last paragraph?
No. Yes.
Are there similar rules regarding banks?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, that's honestly a good question. I would bet that there are, but I can't tell you right off the top of my head.
Okay. Representative Garrett.
Two questions, Mr.
Absolutely.
Chair. First question, for Mr. Scroggins. What percentage of credit unions currently have public funds on deposit?
What percentage of credit unions currently have public funds on deposit? Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, I don't have an answer to that. Of course, they're all under the insured amount. Based on, my anecdotal understanding of my clients, I would have to guess it's probably, 40 to 50%, but there is nothing scientific about that answer. That's just based on my own practice. We do represent in some form or another most of the credit unions in Oregon and Washington, so, but again, that's just based on my anecdotal evidence.
Follow up, Mr.
Yes.
Chip. And what's the present rate of return on those deposits?
Representative Garrard, Mr. Chair, that would, of course, vary by the credit union and by the nature of the deposit, depending on whether it's in a checking account or depending on whether it's in a long-term certificate or something like that. And that might range anywhere from, a quarter of a percent, 25 basis points, up to, if it were in a longer-term certificate, 2 or 3% right now. Of course, rates are very low right now. But depending on what the investment was, that would probably be a good range or estimate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, we do have tracking services that track quarterly, comparisons between CD rates for banks and credit unions fees. And I can get you the latest report on that.
I would appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps you've missed my stunning floor speeches, but I have a fundamental objection to us going into a short 3-week special session and doing major legislation. And as you mentioned, Pam, I've been aware of this as being sort of on the radar, and certainly I was part of the 2003 legislation. So my question is, what emergency that a major piece such as this would come forward in this very brief session through a committee bill, not even a sponsored bill, that would compel me to say, oh, we've got to deal with this in a very short time frame?
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, that's certainly an excellent question, and one that I suspect that everybody coming before the legislature in various committees are getting asked, because there are certainly a number of bills that are not considered emergency that have been introduced. I can tell you that since we have been working on this bill for several years, we finally got to a point, really only a few weeks ago, where we had a bill that the Treasurer's Office and our regulators and us as an organization could agree to move forward. And the timing was that we needed to move forward now. I certainly understand the argument of what emergency does this cause. I don't have an excellent answer for you, but I truly believe this is an opportunity that we have to get this bill after several years through, and I'm certainly not going to turn down that opportunity.
Other questions for this panel? Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Thank you to each of you. I appreciate you bringing the issue. Mr. Berrick, I think you mentioned one of the benefits was increased rate of return. Could you provide any data that shows in the 19 other states where this program is similar, that the rate of return is higher to public funds than what Oregon is receiving?
Representative Hannah and Chair Roblin, I don't have any specific data on that. I can tell you that, and it kind of goes back to Representative Gerard's question as well. I tell you, in the case of Advantis, what we do is we currently pay public entities the same rate that we're paying for consumer deposits. And it just so happens in Advantis's case that we're ranked number one in the nation in returning financial value to members by Callahan & Associates, which is a national research and consulting firm. So I know they already are getting a very good deal on their deposits that they have with us right now. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they can't keep very much with us right now, so they're not getting the full benefit. But I don't have specific data on that. Pam, I don't know if you have anything on the other 19 states.
Chair Roblin, Representative Hannah, not specifically on the 19 states. As I said, we do data track on credit unions and banks throughout the nation, but we can certainly look into that.
And I could supply comparative rates between Advantis and our competitors, banks in the area, and they're going to show that clearly our rates are higher.
Just as a follow-up.
Yeah. And I appreciate you speaking for your entity, because I understand that. That's not a bad thing. But really, we're talking about all credit union as an industry and state funds as a group. Right. And I'm trying to understand if they're doing it in 19 other states, do those 19 other states have a better rate of return on public funds than we do? I mean, just so we know if we're comparing apples to apples here.
Right.
And so follow-up question, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. I think one of you mentioned about meeting lending demand. Is there pent-up demand for lending? I mean, do you have a pent-up business demand for lending? And how will these public funds create that opportunity for you?
Yes, Representative Hannah and Chair Roblin. There is a lot of demand for business lending. It's ironic that you bring that up, because it's a totally another issue. But small businesses are really pressed right now for sources of liquidity, capital. Of course, everyone's seen the President's $30 billion initiative for small businesses. And credit unions have an opportunity to be able to help small businesses with their liquidity needs or capital needs. And by injecting additional public funds deposits into credit unions, it's only going to create that much more liquidity for those small businesses. Small business lending is something that's, for many credit unions, it's kind of a recent phenomenon. It's happened mostly in the last 5 or 7 years, but it's expanded exponentially, and we are a wonderful option to provide that capital. We do have some restrictions on how much we can lend out to small businesses, but yes, the short answer to your question is those funds would go back in the local community. Demand is very strong for small business loans right now. Other types of credit has been a little bit off because of the economic situation, not surprisingly. But yeah, there definitely would be demand for those funds from local businesses.
Representative
Berger. Yeah, could I follow up just briefly on that, his remarks? As I understand it, this money is now deposited through the banking system, and this change would make it deposited through either the bank or, but it wouldn't change the liquidity demands that you're talking about. It's the same money, is it not?
Yes, Representative Berger, it's the same money, but of course, it's a question of how much people are willing to lend at this point. And in many cases, and I don't want to speak for the banking industry, but it's pretty well known that banks have cut back on lending. And in fact, I just was reading an article in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend about regulators imploring banks to be lending more to their small business customers. So it is the same money, that's true. It's just a question of is it getting loaned out.
Yes. One more. Follow up.
I guess, again, what happens in the Wall Street Journal doesn't necessarily happen in Oregon, and we have a lot of community banks in our state, and I'm very concerned that it's the same money. It's just deposited differently, and it won't necessarily follow that they won't lend it and you will. But that's, I guess, what I'm getting at when I say it's the same money, and I appreciate your testimony.
Further questions of this panel? I guess my only question, you've seen the amendment, and are you in favor of the amendment to the bill, and if there's any suggestions you might have?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, most of the amendment is just fine. Most of the amendment is technical, and a lot of it actually doesn't really have anything to do necessarily with our bill, but makes some minor amendments related to the legislation that was passed last year. It's the last section that we would have an objection to on the amendment, and that essentially says that if there aren't sufficient credit unions participating by some undefined point, which I read to be next year. I understand that the Treasurer's Office reads it to be 2012, but at any rate, at some point before either next year's session or a 2012 session, if there aren't sufficient credit unions participating, then the Treasurer must propose legislation that would repeal this legislation. And putting aside legislation that directs the Treasurer to propose other legislation and the propriety of that, we would have a problem with that because the idea is that the Treasurer has the discretion and the ability to pull the plug on the program but leave the legislation in place until such time as it's appropriate to resurrect it if there's sufficient participation in the future. I was talking with Mr. Salvaggio from the Treasurer's Office before this hearing. I think we're in the same place conceptually. It's just in terms of drafting the amendment, I don't think it's necessary, and it goes beyond what we would want. Mr. Salvaggio can address whether or not what's in the bill now actually might be sufficient for what they want.
Okay. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. You. Next, Hasina Squires.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, a trade association nonprofit that represents over 900 special service districts that operate throughout the state of Oregon. There are approximately 26 different types of special districts, and many of them are highly dependent on property tax revenue. Some of our districts get 95% of their revenue through the property tax system, and all of those property taxes need somewhere to be deposited. So our interest is in supporting House Bill 3700. I've been working for special districts, I learned this weekend, since 1994. So I definitely remember the 2003 legislative session. I know, look how young I am. I do remember the 2003 legislative session, and I've appeared every time the credit unions have actually brought a piece of legislation similar to this in support of the choice that local government can have in the ability to invest in a credit union. A few statistics for you just so you know what you're dealing with from our association's perspective of the type number of special districts that would be affected. Approximately 18% of our special districts have budgets of over $1 million. 39% of our, or sorry, excuse me, let me back up. 43%, I'll go from the bottom up, 43% of our special districts have budgets, annual budgets of $250,000 to $1 million. 18% of our districts have budgets of over $1 million. So we're talking about 61% of people hit that 250 threshold and above, and 39% are below it. We as an association and all of our members do believe that as public funds, the custodian of public funds, it's important for local governments to earn interest on all of our funds whenever possible. We do support all of our local institutions, including banks, and not so we have enjoyed and will continue to enjoy our relationship with the banks. I've just heard from our membership over time, especially those ones in the rural areas, that they just don't understand why they can't deposit into a credit union, and they would like to, and what is the barrier there? So we've been supportive in the past. I just want to make one final comment about this issue, is that we don't really see this as a choice of credit unions versus banks. If we're provided this option, we'll likely deposit in both, but it really is just a choice and another alternative for a local government to invest in a different type of public depository.
Question to Representative Berger.
I have seen it under current law in small in communities, a small special district can invest up to $250,000. That would be a quarter of $1 million. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that is absolutely correct. So this would be for those districts that fall above the 250 threshold. So that would be about 61% of our special districts.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this witness? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Yes.
And because of the previous testimony about the treasurers, it would be good to have our treasurer office come up now, because I know he has another committee he has to be at in a short few moments, so I'll have him explain what the amendment does, and then you can possibly answer the question, whatever, that posed in the last one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will speak, and then you can decide if I've answered your questions.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair.
For the record, Michael Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. The State Treasurer and the State Treasury feel that this policy option is a decision for the legislature, and as such, we're remaining neutral on the policy. However, if the legislature wishes to establish such a policy, the Treasury urges adoption of the Dash 1 amendments at this time. The original HB 3700 rewrote portions of ORS 295, and as was described by the credit unions, added triggers to ensure that the program drew participants when it was started up, and that is five credit unions with commitments of deposits. The original draft also inserted a deadline of June 30th, 2011. Until that date, the Treasury can accept money and commitments with which to establish the program from credit unions. The changes that we made with the Dash 1 amendments firstly undo a lot of general Chapter 295 rewrites because we felt that was too comprehensive for this short session. It also makes two technical fixes that we would ask for regardless of HB 3700. And then Section 31, which was submitted as a just-in-case clause, clarifies that the Treasury does submit a sunset to the next legislature after that cutoff date that I mentioned, just to ensure that if the Treasury is prohibited from receiving funds with which to run the program, we need not run the program. I think that that's self-explanatory, but as Mr. Scoggins noted, I think conceptually we're in the same place on this, and I'll be speaking with him after this this hearing. Just to put on record that Mr. Scoggins is right, this would, as is my understanding, as is Treasury's understanding, be the 2012 session, if there was a 2012 session, not the 2011 session. So in that instance, the issue would be represented to the legislature.
Questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you. So under the Dash 1 amendments, if what would happen in the 2012 that please.
Under the original bill, it is written into the bill that we have only until June 30, 2011 to accept funds with which to start up the program. And our concern was, well, what happens after that date passes? And we wanted to make explicit that if we're not able to receive funds for this program, then we don't need to run it, and therefore we have legislative council recommended we put in Section 31, which tells us to submit a sunset to the legislature and shut down this particular shop.
Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mike. I understand there is no, at this point, current fiscal impact. Are you anticipating that the Treasurer's Office would need more FTEs to run this, because it involves a whole another sort of group?
We estimate a single FTE.
Okay.
And there is no fiscal been submitted?
No, we haven't seen it yet.
Well, I'm sure that we can provide that by the next hearing.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. I haven't seen it. Any other questions? Representative Hanna.
Thank you. My question pertains to, if the funds don't come into the system, I'm being specific, I'm looking at this Section 13, the Treasurer may accept monies from any public or private source, including credit unions, but if the money doesn't come in to pay the expenses, do you have a funding source?
Chair Rowland, members of the committee, no, we do not. The funding source in the current bank pool is paid from the banks who participate, and as in this situation, the idea would be that the funding would come from the participating credit unions with startup funds necessary to get it off the ground, which would, per Section 13, come from outside sources as well.
Follow up?
What kind of outside sources? Help us understand what that might be.
Ideally, Chair and members of the committee, ideally that would be from the participating credit unions. We wanted that broad enough in case, for instance, the Credit Union Association wished to kick this off. We wouldn't want to not be able to accept the money for a legitimate purpose.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And our final panel that signed up, and if there's others, just let us know you want to. Linda Navarro, Raymond Davis, and Lark Wisham. And I hope I get those all right. Speaking of some Legion friends.
Look. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Navarro, and I'm the President and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. We were founded in 1905, and we represent the banks, commercial banks, savings banks, and trust companies that do business in the state of Oregon. But we're here today primarily on behalf of the independent community banks that are headquartered in this state, as they are the local businesses that will be most impacted by this legislation. And by the way, community banks doing business in Oregon currently have on their books $40 billion in loans to Oregonians and Oregon businesses. I'm joined today by two Oregon bankers, Ray Davis, the Chief Executive Officer of Umpqua Bank, which is the largest state-chartered bank headquartered in Oregon, as well as Lark Wisham, the immediate past chair of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Chief Financial Officer of Citizens Bank, a community bank headquartered in Corvallis, Oregon. Lark was also integrally involved in the development of Oregon's current public deposit protection program. We are all three here today in strong opposition to HB 3700. And truthfully, we're somewhat perplexed by why this bill is being heard in this short session, as it was heard in the 2009 session and considered by committee. But since it's before you, we are compelled to be here again and talk about this important and very complex issue of public deposit protection, as well as credit union competition. There are many important issues you're addressing this session, and from our perspective, this one just doesn't make sense for Oregon, particularly during an economically challenging time. The consequences of this legislation would be damaging to Oregon's community banks, and we hope to paint a picture of that today. I've personally worked on the issue of public deposit protection for well over 10 years, how they're collateralized and how they're protected. And I can say with 100% confidence and personal experience that this is an extremely complex program. You've got just a taste of that today. But you need only look at the bill and the wording in that bill to understand that we went through dozens of drafts of legislation over a couple of sessions, hundreds of hours of volunteer time by bankers, by local governments, cities and counties, by the Treasury, to create this program in partnership and in such a way that was designed to protect local governments' deposits while preserving the relationship those depositors have with local banks. In my view, to think that this program could be translated in almost a cookie-cutter fashion to the credit union industry is really a mistake, especially in such an abbreviated session. Mr. Ken Sherman, Jr., who's been counsel for the OBA for over 30 years, is in the back of the room, and he literally spent hundreds and hundreds of hours creating the program that we have today. So I just can't stress enough the complexity of it. But in addition to that, there are a few other facts that I think should be made very clear, and I will turn the testimony over in just a moment to Mr. Davis and Ms. Weisham to talk about the impact on community banks, but I'd like to make a couple of additional points about credit unions. You know, the largest credit unions have done a very good job over the years hiding behind the small credit union image to preserve their government advantages. And now they're doing it to go after public deposits. And this is something that's always been in the commercial banking arena, and it belongs there. And they do have the ability to serve the smallest local governments and even a portion of larger local governments through the $250,000 in deposit authority they have today. But the reality about credit unions in today's environment is that many have community charters with virtually no restriction in service areas. They often serve higher income and business customers. They, in our view, clearly want to be have the powers that are extended to commercial banks, essentially having a competitive advantage that being tax exempt provides, but basically seeking the business that's readily sought after by commercial banks. In our view, they've strayed from their mission, and this is not all credit unions, this is some credit unions, to compete head-on with commercial banks. And these are the credit unions that will go after public deposits. And with their advantages, they may be successful in attracting some of those deposits out of the community banking industry. And this isn't just rhetoric, it's fact. The second largest depository institution headquartered in this state, which is second only to Umpqua Bank in its asset size, is On Point Credit Union, the former Portland Teachers Credit Union, which has approximately $2.7 billion in assets as of the September 2009 report published by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This is a perfect example of a credit union that's morphed beyond its original purpose. And it's not the only one. If you look at First Tech, it's $2.2 billion in assets. There are only three banks headquartered in the state of Oregon, including Umpqua Bank, that have over $2 billion in assets. Credit unions that have, there are many credit unions that have stayed true to their original purpose and the reason that they were given tax exempt status. They have common bonds and they work for, they serve employer groups and associations and often serve people of modest means. And I bring that up because credit unions in 1934, when they were given their tax exemption, were chartered to serve people of modest means. So I'm hoping that I've painted somewhat of a picture that we're talking about two distinct kinds of credit unions that have emerged in recent years. And in Oregon, we have some that fall into that very fast, very aggressive, tax-exempt category that compete head-on every day for community banks that have to pay taxes on their first dollar of profits. with credit unions that can offer virtually identical services, competing in what has been released by the Government Accountability Office and the Community Reinvestment Coalition as a higher income and higher net worth customer and higher educated customer than the average bank. So just moving quickly, I want to make one more point, and that is about mutual savings banks. In Oregon, there are two mutual savings banks, First Federal Savings Bank of McMinnville and Evergreen Federal Savings Bank of Grants Pass. These two mutual savings banks are structured in a manner that's similar to credit unions. They are owned and governed by their members. But mutual savings institutions lost their non-tax status in 1952 and have been paying taxes ever since. Other cooperatively owned companies from Sunkist to REI also pay taxes. What service does a credit union like OnPoint Credit Union provide that's really any different than First Federal or Evergreen Federal? And yet these smaller local savings banks are at a distinct competitive disadvantage to aggressive credit unions in their market that are allowed to morph without any reexamination of their charter and extended additional powers. All these points are important and germane to this bill because the truth is that it's Oregon's bank-like credit unions that are among those that would seek to pull dollars out of local community banks. For credit unions that are chomping at the bit to have more powers and bank-like powers, they have options. They can convert to mutual savings banks. It's happened in many states. Or perhaps they could step up and pay taxes. Look only to the state of Washington to see the tie that they've made between paying taxes and being able to accept public deposits for credit unions. So in closing, HB 3700 is just bad public policy from our perspective. It caters to a special interest at the expense of a long-standing and important industry to this state. Moreover, it is offered in this abbreviated session where there's insufficient time for the legislature to fully vet and understand the consequences of this major policy change. We should all be focused right now on adding capacity for extending credit to our local communities, not robbing Peter to pay Paul, with the added consequence of taking business out of tax-paying community banks and putting it into tax-exempt corporations. This bill does absolutely nothing to increase lending capacity in local financial institutions and, in fact, does just the opposite. So on behalf of Oregon's 55 banks and particularly the 34 headquartered in our state, I strongly urge you to oppose 3700. And I will note that we have not seen Dash 1 amendments. We were not even given an opportunity to see this bill in advance of session. But it makes, there were some claims made about the technical issues in this bill that our council has reviewed and found to be inaccurate. For example, Section 13, if you go look at it carefully, it talks about funding through voluntary contributions. Section 12, which deals with a credit union that fails and how they're covered by the pool. It does not deal with the initial startup costs for this program. So we do think there's some technical issues in the drafting of this bill as well that we would be happy to weigh in on at some point. But overall, we urge you to reject this legislation.
Thank you, Chairman Roblin and members of the Rules Committee. Thank you for having me here today to testify to you. First, a word about Umpqua Bank.
Be sure and identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Ray Davis. I'm President CEO of Umpqua, yep. Umpqua Bank. Thanks. Umpqua Bank is Oregon's bank. It was founded in 1953 in Canyonville, Oregon. We are now located throughout Oregon, Washington, and Northern California. And what was once a small, sleepy community bank is now one of the largest, one of the strongest community banks in the entire United States, with assets in excess of $10 billion with 162 locations throughout our footprint. Umpqua Bank is proud of our Oregon heritage and will never forsake the communities that have supported us over the years as we've grown. Umpqua Bank is also proud to say that we are headquartered in Oregon.
one of the only few publicly traded companies with headquarters in Oregon that now call this beautiful state home. As Oregon's largest community bank, a few additional facts should be pointed out. Umpqua's belief in supporting youth and education was once again evidenced with our associates this past year volunteering over 35,000 hours of volunteerism to our communities throughout 2009. We have actively supported the state stimulus programs and have worked closely with the governor's office on his sustainability initiatives. Last year, we created jobs. We created jobs in the state of Oregon. We currently have over 100 positions that we're trying to fill as we speak. Due to the size of our bank store footprint, and this is important, we import over $50 million a day into Oregon. $50 million a day into Oregon. Now, recently, there's been a lot of talk about banks failing to lend in their communities. And this may be true in those instances where banks, savings and loans, credit unions are stressed, where they're having difficulties like small businesses are having troubles to get through this terrible economic recession. This is not the case with Umpqua Bank, as well as most other community banks throughout the state. Last year, Umpqua Bank's total loan production exceeded $1.7 billion, with over $1 billion of that in Oregon, in this state. The facts speak for themselves. It has become a populist movement to believe that banks are not lending money. And like I said, in those cases where banks are stressed, I believe there's evidence of that, but there's evidence in all types of financial institutions. Overall, community banks continue to support the local communities and their small businesses with very active and robust lending programs. To state otherwise is just not true. The reason these facts are important to today's topic is to let you know that, contrary again to public opinion, that the community banks of this state are doing all they can to support the local communities, provide credit to small businesses, and be a catalyst to help Oregon recover from this past recession. So that brings me to the topic of the day, House Bill 3700, and what I believe are its unintended negative impacts on Oregon community banks. There's no question that this bill would create hardship for our small community banks throughout the state of Oregon. We also know it creates another competitive advantage for credit unions in addition to their tax-free status. A few points. First one, let's clear this up. Representative Berger, you're absolutely correct. This bill will not add any additional liquidity to our communities. None. Zero. Whatever liquidity is put into a deposit into a credit union has to be collateralized for this bill at 100%, which deems a security illiquid. So there will be no additional liquidity. If credit unions want to loan money to small businesses, there's nothing stopping them right now today. If they have the money to collateralize these deposits, why aren't they redeeming those securities and lending the money out? They have the same liquidity today. There's a fallacy to this bill that is just untrue. President Obama has recently stated the community banks are the backbone of lending in America, since they provide the vast majority of small business loans throughout the land. I don't think any of us can debate that. Oregon needs its community banks, especially now. House Bill 3700 would negatively impact small community banks' profitability and the related support that they give to the nonprofits and to other small businesses throughout their footprints. The question really is, why would the Oregon legislature wish to polarize the community banks in times when we need to work together? We need to do the right thing. We need to figure out how do we take this state out of this recessionary period quicker, faster, better as we possibly can. And to polarize different segments of the financial industry makes no sense and is non-productive to making these things happen. The other question is the timing of this bill. It's come up. What's the rush? Here's a question. There are a number of community banks in the state of Oregon that are under stress, that are teetering, And they don't need another legislative rule to come down on them, which makes them weaker, which is exactly what this would do. Let me put it in a, give you an example. If you're a small community bank in Lake Oswego or Coos Bay or Prineville, wherever you may be, and you have money on deposit from a public entity that is withdrawn because credit unions decide they can offer a higher rate because they are tax-free, that money is taken away. And if that small community bank needs that liquidity, it has to take the security that is pledged and sell them and redeem it. It's possible that they have to redeem that security at a loss. If they do that, that hurts the profitability of that bank, which puts all deposits of that institution, some perhaps your constituents, at risk. Why? This is not the time for this bill. If this bill would go through the normal process of vetting out the pros and the cons so we all understand just exactly what the impact is to small community banks, we do that. I will tell you, there are probably in excess, and I'm not exaggerating when I tell you this, 20 banks in the Pacific Northwest, Oregon, Washington, that are teetering on collapse. Do you think this is the right time to make it more difficult for those institutions? Keep this in mind. Those institutions are small businesses, just like the cleaners, just like the auto dealer in the towns you represent. There is no difference. These are small businesses trying to survive a very difficult economic period of time. The timing of this bill has to be questioned. And if you believe the bill is going to penalize the large banks, like Umpqua, Bank of America, some of the very, very large banks, think again. It's not going to punish the large institutions. I'm actually not so much here for Umpqua Bank as I am here for the rest of the community banks that could be severely damaged. And I don't want to see them fail. Taxpayers' dollars in tax-free institutions will result and do result in a decrease in income to community banks and consequently lost revenues to the state. You all know that. And that's right after we've just increased taxes, which were raised without consideration, I would believe, of the tax-free status of credit unions. Some people here in Salem, I understand, and I'm not a politician, you can probably tell, have stated that this bill is being quickly brought to vote in retribution to Oregon bankers taking a position against Measures 66 and 67. I ask the question, payback for what? For standing up and voicing their opinion? For doing what they thought was right? I also believe that credit unions stayed out of this fight because they didn't want to bring light to their own tax-free status. They remained neutral. Let's face it, political gamemanship is taking its toll on Oregon's community banks in the wake of very troubling economic times. It's a very populist movement right now that if you're a bank, you're bad because of the excesses on Wall Street. And let me remind everybody that the community banks of this great state did not originate subprime loans, did not create derivatives that are impossible to explain, have not taken multi-million dollar bonuses, and certainly did not receive bailout money from the government. These are hardworking folks trying to support their communities, giving money to the charities, to the nonprofits, and they're struggling. They're struggling very hard. And for this bill to be rushed through without proper vetting is just irresponsible. I think that this is the time not to polarize community banks from state government. It serves no purpose. It's a serious time. It calls for serious leadership. And I think I can say, certainly for Umpqua Bank and for the other community banks around the state, that we continue to stand ready to partner with state government and to work together with mutual respect and consultation towards meeting the needs of the state and its constituents. The introduction of a surprise bill in a short session without thorough debate is not productive to the health of Oregon. And Oregon needs Oregon's community banks. Don't polarize us. ask us to work with you for the common good. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Lark Weisham. I'm Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer at Citizens Bank in Corvallis, Oregon. Citizens Bank is a 52-year-old locally owned bank. During that time, we have worked with public entities, and we are a trusted partner with our public entities. We have over $400 million in assets, $318 million in local deposits, and $307 million in loans. We have 13 branches throughout the Willamette Valley. The figures I just gave you of $318 million in deposits and $307 million in loans was as of the end of December. I can tell you as of to date, for every dollar we have in deposits, we have a loan. We are mostly in the business of loans to small and medium-sized businesses, and we've been doing that for 52 years. I've personally been a local banker for 31 years, and I am a resident of Benton County. I am pleased to be here today to share with you what I hope you believe is an important perspective on this bill, that of a relatively small but significant and safe and sound community bank. Despite what you might hear, Oregon banks are lending. We make every loan that meets our underwriting standards, and I take exception to the rhetoric that is being tossed around about banks not lending without looking at the facts. The Division of Finance and Corporate Securities can confirm that Oregon banks are actively lending. If there is a loan that can be appropriately underwritten by an Oregon bank, there are banks able and willing to make that loan. Additionally, Oregon banks are actively working with their business customers in these difficult times to help them succeed. Our loan officers are seasoned business lenders, and we are helping these businesses try to get it through these difficult times. We want them to succeed. We're also an important part of the communities we serve. We do not just make loans to businesses and farms. We partner with them to help them succeed, which makes our community viable. We are an active partner in our communities, serving them with time and donations. Public deposits are extremely important to our bank and all community banks. And I can assure you that the deposit protection program is very complex. I was on the committee that helped write the current public law in Oregon. We worked hard to protect the public entities while at the same time retaining the importance of these deposits to Oregon banks. I personally put in more than 100 hours of time on this legislation, along with other stakeholders, including cities, counties, and the state treasury. In fact, I've been involved in this issue for over a decade. This was a collaborative effort and very involved. It isn't reasonable to say that credit unions can just mirror this program without understanding the ramifications. Large banks offer sophisticated government banking services for the largest public fund depositories in Oregon. These depositories will continue to do business with these large banks. The impact of this legislation will be on banks like Citizens Bank, your locally owned community bank. We tend to bank the smaller public entities. This shifts liquidity out of tax-paying Oregon banks into tax-advantaged credit unions. How does this help our state and local businesses? Last year, Citizens Bank alone paid over $430,000 in state taxes. Citizens Bank has stayed profitable in this recession. We are safe and sound, and we are actively lending. Our core niche is small and medium-sized businesses and agricultural customers, and we pay our fair share of income tax. Why should Citizens Bank and other community banks be harmed further by public policy that favors non-taxpaying credit unions? The bill will take away a source of our funding for loans in our communities based on an intent or agenda that is entirely unclear and unfounded. In closing, I respectfully ask why this legislation, which is nothing new, is being considered in such a short session that I understood to be for emergency issues. The issues and impact on this legislation on community banks is extremely complex. Rushing it not only makes no sense to me, but it's damaging to our small bank industry that I have been a part of for more than 30 years. Thank you for your time.
Yeah. Questions? Sure. Representative Nolan.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Davis, you seem to repeat anonymous gossip in your testimony, and I can think of only two purposes for doing so. One would either be to associate yourself with that gossip, and the other would be to repudiate it. And I'd like a clarification on what your purpose was.
What gossip?
You made reference to anonymous conversations about what motivated this bill.
Oh, I made my own. That was my own observation. That this is, I know how the OBA voted on this bill, and I am surmising that this could be potentially for retribution. And if it is, if it isn't, great. If it is, then shame on all of us. It's not right.
Follow up. Have you spoken with anyone associated with introducing this bill before you suggested what their motives were?
I have spoken to other people in this bill, yes.
Clarification? People involved in the introduction of this bill?
In the introduction of the bill, I have spoken, I don't believe so. No, ma'am.
Thank you. No, ma'am. I'd welcome you to talk with my office if you'd like to, although this bill did not originate out of my office.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Representative Garrard.
Thank you. I asked the credit union folks basically the same question, but I'm curious if the banks are faced with losing a substantial deposit in public funds to the credit to a aggressive credit union, mm-hmm. why would you not match their rate of return to preserve that deposit?
Chair Roblin and Representative Jard, there's a tax advantage to rates. We pay taxes, and we have to manage margins in our bank. And so we have to manage the margin between what we earn on loans, what we pay on deposits, and the margin covers overhead and taxes. If I didn't have to pay $430,000 in state taxes, I could offer a heck of a lot better rates to some of those public entities. But I can tell you, those public entities are important to my bank. So when somebody comes to me and they have a special rate, we look at the whole relationship. And if we have a long-term relationship with that public entity, I'm going to do everything I can to match that rate. And where I'm going to try to make it up is by making a good loan that I'm going to collect and not take losses on and make up that margin. But when I have initially that huge tax disadvantage, it's hard.
Just a clarification. So what you're saying is it would create a hardship, but you probably would match it.
It would create a hardship, but it'd be very difficult to match in our bank, yes.
Okay.
And if those funds moved out now, with me being at 100% loan-to-deposit ratio, I got to scramble to make up that money. I've got that money committed in loans. And so if that public entity comes in tomorrow and pulls $5 million out of my bank to move it to a credit union that's paying 10 basis points more, I've got to scramble and find $5 million somewhere because I've got a loan out there that could be a 20-year loan. It's going to have a huge impact.
Thank you for your response.
Rep. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, since this isn't a new issue to the legislature, it's been up before, I would appreciate having the benefit of maybe analysis that's been done, if not this session, then in previous years, about in the other 19 states that do allow these deposits, what has been the adverse impact on community banks that you're telling us we should be leery of in Oregon?
Chair Roblin, Representative Garrett, I appreciate you bringing that up, because I did want to make one point that I didn't have an opportunity to make in my testimony that speaks to your question. I heard reference as well to 19 other states having this program, and in fact, I wrote down that the exact words were this same model. I would argue that there isn't a single other state in the country that has this same model. The closest model to public deposit protection to Oregon is Washington, because we initially based our program on the Washington program, but we made several changes to that program to further protect public depositors as well as the pool participants from participating banks that participate in the shared liability pool. And I think there's only three states in the whole country that have shared liability pools. And there's only one like Oregon's. So there are not 19 states with this model. What there probably are, and I haven't verified this fact, is 19 states that have some level of public deposit authority extended to credit unions. But how they protect those deposits, how they compete, and at what level is something that we would have to research to be able to compare apples to apples. But what we can do is do some analysis of what kind of impact it would have on community banks if a certain percentage of their public deposits were to migrate out of banks. And that would not be that hard to do, because most banks in the state of Oregon are also at close to 100% loan-to-deposit ratio, so they would have a very specific impact, just like Citizens Bank, if those deposits were to leave their institutions.
Further questions? Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I can't remember which of you mentioned the number of state chartered banks, 34 state chartered banks. Well, for the bankers, do you think this legislation would negatively impact a bank's decision to be or stay, to become or stay a state chartered bank?
Would you like to take that one?
I'll speak for Umpqua Bank. You know, it's the largest state chartered institution. Yes, I think it makes other alternatives perhaps more viable. The last thing that Umpqua Bank wants to do is to no longer be a state chartered bank. We certainly have options to become a national chartered bank. I don't think that's, I know that's not in the best interest of the state, because it would impact the budget. The budget by approximately $500,000, which is what we're paying into the Department of Finance. So that's not. I think that perhaps an answer that I would respond to you, Representative Hanna, is that why polarize banks or credit unions now? It just doesn't make any sense in very difficult times. I would guess that the 19 states, if there are 19 states that have some other type of program, were probably originated before this economic recession, I'm guessing, but I would bet it is. And you've got banks right now that are seriously struggling, and the last thing they need is to have the state bear down on them. What they do need, and what they should be prepared to do, is to meet with the state anywhere you want and try to figure out how do we advance this state. By advancing the state, the community banks win. By advancing the state, credit unions win. And that's what we should be doing.
May I respond to that?
Sure.
Yes. Chair Roland and Representative Hanna. I think for Citizens Bank, because we are a small, locally owned community bank, we would not change our charter. But as I explained before, if credit unions take public funds out of our bank, we will be severely impacted. Again, for every dollar I have in deposits, I have in a loan. And for 90 days from now, a public entity to go to the credit union and they can pay them 50 basis more because they don't have a tax liability is severely going to hurt our community bank. And I can tell you that we only make loans in our community. And our niche, the last part of business left for community banks, is small to medium-sized business and farms. It's our niche. We're experts at it. We're helping our businesses. We're just not making them loans. We're coaching them. They come in and they ask for our help. And we have literally
Our loan officers, we have asked every single loan officer in our bank to go out and meet with their business customer. And I'm not kidding, they have met with all of them. We're trying to head off those businesses running into problems before it happens so we can help them. And if our public funds left our bank overnight, we would have a liquidity problem. And we would have to do something about that very quickly. It would present a huge problem for us. Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you. I can see that you are surprised, as I am, to have this come forward now, and I heard your testimony that you were working last session on something along this order. Is there some way that this thing could become palatable to banks, some amendment or other language that would move this forward in, say, some other session rather than a three-week one?
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, thank you for the question. You know, in answering off the top of my head, I think the only thing that would make this palatable is if credit unions were put on a level playing field with community banks when they're competing for commercial banking activity. And that means they would have to be taxed just like community banks if they were to be extended the same business lending authority at the federal level or public deposit authority at the state level. It's that simple. If they want to retain their tax-exempt status, they should stay within their mission of serving people with limited means or within common bond employer and association groups. They want to move outside of that, then they should be put on a level playing field with community banks. So if you were prepared to move forward with a proposal to tax credit unions in a way that community banks are taxed, then we probably wouldn't be able to argue the same points that we're arguing today.
Further questions? I guess I only have two. One, I want to make a statement, and that is that I apologize if we didn't get you the amendments as quick as we can. If you don't have them, we'll make sure you get them, because I think that's very important. I always would make sure that happens, and if there's ever a chance where you think something may be coming, if you talk to our administrator, I've given her permission to give it to you as soon as we have it. So, because I don't think that, I think it's best for everybody to see what we're working on, so we'll continue to do that. And I guess the other question I have is about polarization. I think we are already polarized. I mean, I was on a, you know, I tend to be in my local community as a high school principal. We worked with lots of banks, with both student body account funds and sure. The school district. With and Umpqua is one of those in our community that we've always worked with, and they have been a great community asset. At the same time, I was on a board with a credit union, so I've watched this, and this particular issue has been one that has polarized them for as long as I've been around. I mean, there's always been this issue about these public funds and so on. So I'm not sure that this has polarized it, and I'm not sure that, well, we know it's not a new issue. It is a continuing issue, and it's one that I think a lot of people have put a lot of time in. And I would personally commend the Banking Association on having structured a system in the state of Oregon that does make safe those deposits. And whether you think that you can just take it and use it in another deal, I would say that you made it, from my perspective, a pretty good model that if anybody was out there looking at, I would recommend that they come and look at that model, because I think it does do a good job of protecting public funds. So I guess to the polarity, I think we are going to always, it's kind of like doctors and nurses, another bill that we had here earlier about testers and plumbers. Whenever there are issues that divide, you know, one group gets and one doesn't, it's that scope of practice issue that is always there. So I'm not sure it gets any more polarized or not. It just depends on which side it comes out of. And I would love to have your answer.
May I comment? Yes, yeah. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. There's no question. I think you're right. I guess my comments really were aimed at, in this economic period of time, why risk, even risk, additional polarization when the state needs help, community bankers need help? Why aren't we working together to figure out the thing, work through these things that make sense? And I can tell you right now, the community banks are prepared to do that. We always have been. I think we've done a pretty good job, actually, with the state. Could we do better? You betcha. But I mean, the biggest concern I've got right now is for me, I think the bill has got serious flaws to it. But for a timing point of view, this bill is hurtful, and it makes no good sense.
Thank you. Further questions? I thank you all for your testimony.
Thank you.
There's no one else on the list. Is there anyone else here who was jumping at the chance to be able to speak that didn't get their name on the list? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3700. And I will also let people know that we will carry over both the public hearing, because I think there's some questions that we should be getting some answers back to that were asked at this deal, and possible work session to the next, to Wednesday. So we'll carry that over. But thank you very much.
Well, they're filing out.
Two more bills.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, I've got 5 o'clock. So do I. Excused.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Is there enough of us?
I'll stay. Stay
for a little while. Okay. We'll be there with the one. I know. But I'd like to have both of us here. I have a couple of people hear us. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3671 and on 3638 at the same time, because they're really about the same issues. And we have the same witnesses, so they can talk to both things at the same time, and we can maybe get as much as we can here. And I would invite Representative Hannah, do you want to speak to yours and the amendments first?
Sure.
That would be great. And you can go down there or where you are, whichever you feel
stay
comfortable.
Stay right here.
Okay,
all right.
That's fine with me.
Okay with you, since there's only a few of us left in the room.
Exactly.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bruce Hanna, State Representative from House District 7. I appreciate, once again, the opportunity to visit with the committee about House Bill 3638. As I mentioned before, it is an ethics reform bill to protect legislators from using their elected position to obtain higher-paying jobs within certain portions of state government. I have testified on this bill at a previous hearing, but I'd like to repeat a few of the key points. House Bill 3638 works by imposing a waiting period on legislators before they can seek and obtain non-elected positions in the executive branch. Specifically, House Bill 3638 prohibits a former member of the Legislative Assembly from receiving a salary for serving as a public official in state government during the period beginning on the date the person ceases being a member and ending on the date of adjournment sine die of the next regular legislative session. That may sound complicated, but it is identical to the language we used in the other bill. The bill is an extension of the law we passed in 2007 to require legislators to wait before they can become a lobbyist. In fact, as I mentioned, 3638 simply adds a new subsection to that statute. As I have said before, if we are going to temporarily ban legislators from seeking certain positions in the private sector, we should also temporarily ban them from seeking similar positions in the private sector. I'd also like to repeat that, in my opinion, a mandatory waiting period is the only way we can assure a fair process for hiring people or promoting current employees within an agency. A waiting period is the only way to ensure that legislators are not allowed to job hunt in the executive branch while they are in office and are not allowed to quickly move through a hiring process that may be already stacked in their favor. After conversations about how to improve this legislation, we decided to offer an amendment that excludes positions as judges. If a legislator wishes to seek office as a judge, we are recognizing that the state of Oregon has had a more difficult enough time in finding qualified judges, and for the most part, those judges are not involved in this legislative process. We've had other conversations about whether or not it was appropriate to amend this bill and try and carve out other executive branch positions, but at the end of the day, coming up with criteria is complicated and arbitrary. The language that is already in House Bill 3638 is clean, clear, and exactly mirrors that which already exists in statute. So I'm not interested in tweaking the bill, and I believe further amendments would do that unnecessarily.
In closing, I believe the only way to completely eliminate conflicts of interest is to require a legislator to leave office and wait until the end of the next legislative session to take an agency job. I would like to send a strong message that the legislature is about, that service in the legislature is about public service, not about using the office as a stepping stone to more lucrative or higher paying positions in state government. I respectfully urge the chair and committee to pass House Bill 3638 with the dash one amendment and send it to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? I guess my only concern, and I think Representative Gelser was here last time, asked that, had to do with there's a lot of jobs in the executive branch, whether it's be at DAS or whatever, where people may have come from, had to give that job up, came here to work, and could not go back to that same job if this bill. So they meet the qualifications, they could go through a hiring process. That's what 3671 does. And they don't lobby. They aren't going to be a part of the lobby process. And so I keep trying to figure out how do we do that, because in the case of a private person, you could go to work for a lobby firm as long as you don't come and lobby the place. So if I wanted to get hired, I could be hired by whatever. And as long as I didn't come and lobby, that would be okay in the private sector. I'm feeling that my own personal is to try to figure out how do we do that same kind of thing so that they can't lobby back here, which would be identical to what other people did for that same period of time. And yours actually would only limit it to 6 months, is that right? I mean, in the minimum. Say I left office, and then the next regular session happened, and then at the end of sign and die, 6 months later, I could then be ready to be hired and lobby.
I think, Mr. Chair, it would be only if you left in midterm would it be a 6 months, right? Because you'd have to wait until sine die the following session.
Yeah, but if I'm here, say it's gone all through the interim, right? Like right now.
Mm-hmm.
If I continue to do this job until just before, or let's say I didn't run in the election, so I'm going to end my term at the end of this year, the next session I couldn't work in. And I could pick up right after that session.
Yes.
So.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's true.
So that'd be the minimum.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, I mean, we've had these conversations,
right.
And I appreciate the opportunity to do it. It is difficult to get it right. It's been my intent to most closely mirror what we currently have in terms of rule for legislators leaving to leave and go to work in the public sector. In the private sector, that rule would be most closely mirrored leaving to go into government work. And, you know, most of us in this legislative process understand that, you know, we build relationships, and the definition of lobbying could be somewhat arbitrary. I mean, to say that you leave and go to work for an agency and you're not a lobbyist, but you spend a significant amount of time here as a legislator, you have built relationships with legislators. Your job title may not be lobbying, but you still have the relationships and ability to have a conversation with people around that. And I just don't want to put good people in a potentially bad position.
Any other questions? We have two people, and you can both come up, and you can talk to either or both of these. Teresa Lucas and Janice Thompson. And thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
And waiting through that whole other testimony.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Teresa Lucas. I'm the Community Outreach Coordinator for Common Sense for Oregon. Common Sense for Oregon is a nonprofit political advocacy organization. We promote better, stronger, and more accountable government. I've submitted written testimony, which I will not be reading to you. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3638 with concerns about House Bill 3671. I should mention that Common Sense for Oregon is currently involved in a lawsuit filed in Marion County concerning Margaret Carter. I cannot discuss the details. For one, I'm not allowed. For two, I'm not a lawyer. But I will tell you that the case was filed to enforce Article 4, Section 30 of the Oregon Constitution, which prohibits legislative self-dealing. And I believe that both of these bills are trying to address that issue. I hope you understand that as a lobbyist, it's a sensitive subject to speak on, to call into question your integrity as legislators, but we believe that House Bill 3638 is a step in the right direction to enforcing and upholding the spirit of Article 4, Section 30. Article 4, Section 30 is more specifically prohibiting creating a position with a bill and then taking that position. 3638 is more addressing the issue of a position that already exists, and that's more of a trading votes kind of deal. We do believe, though, that both of these bills that are being discussed today are addressing the issue, the constitutional issue, and we feel that 3638 is an enforcement of it, whereas I'm concerned that 3671 actually provides some opt-out clauses and weakens the legislation. 3671, if you'll permit me to speak on that, just while we're already doing them together. There's basically three concerns that we have. It employs some dangerously vague language, and I believe that there's some subject to misuse. The bill requires that a position must be advertised for a public, to the public for 2 weeks, either continuously or intermittently. And it does not say what that means. What does advertise mean? Does that mean a radio advertisement, a TV advertisement? Does it just mean that they can put it up on the internet for, you know, a few minutes? Because that's intermittent. Or is it a few hours from midnight to 3 a.m, you know, twice a week? What does that mean? So that's a concern that we have, because the deal is, you know, you want it to be open to the public so that the public can apply for it. Well, how do they get the information? What's the advertising mean? The provisions requiring that an added consideration for other applicants is well intended as well, but it kind of misses the mark, because all it's saying is that you must consider other applicants. Well, what does considering mean? Does that mean you can look at them and say, well, that's nice, but I'm still going to go with this person. This is the person that I wanted. It has no real ability to limit the instance of legislative self-dealing. So those are the kind of three issues that we have with 3671, and we believe that 3638, as Representative Hanna was saying, mirrors the current legislation that we have about lobbyists and private sector, and that's what we believe this bill is supposed to be doing. That's the accountability part that needs to be in there. So that is all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chance Thompson with Common Cause Oregon. Continuing the work of some previous organizations that I represented in past sessions on this topic. When the kind of revolving door legislation was introduced back in 2007, I supported it. And I think I supported it saying that we were lucky that it was not, it was addressing a perception issue and not like a, you know, a burning problem. Having gone down that road, I don't think it's a surprise that this whole issue of administrative type jobs, you know, is coming into play. I guess I'm not seeing that either bill quite hits the mark. It seems like the earlier legislation is really zeroing in on lobbying, and there are one thing, if anything I learned through all this discussions of ethics, there are so many public officials. Representative Bricker, you're chuckling. I knew you would. So, you know, that emphasis in 3638 is just, you know, it's just such a broad definition. And there are just so many jobs. I know that I wasn't able to be here at the earlier testimony, but I was able to listen to it later online, and I know Representative Gelzer brought that up. That said, 36, if you're going to kind of have this whole, you know, waiting period, with, again, kind of a focus on those people coming back to lobby, you can see the logic of applying that element from past law into 36,
You know, it's kind of missing at 36, 37. If I had to choose between these two bills as written, I think I would choose 36, 71. You know, because it's at least, it's just not as, like, again, I'm just troubled by just the emphasis on the public official and just how broad that is. Two features, though, that I, you know, even if the part of the, even if some of the, if the one-year revolving door emphasis from 36-38 was retained more with a lobbying focus, I do think that, so I think this was intended always, and I understand it kind of became a little bit of a problem, is that it not apply to folks you know, returning as a public official. And I think that's not only true if somebody was a legislator and became the holder of a statewide office, but I think even more, you know, we see legislators becoming county commissioners and things like that, and they need to be able to come back. And this whole question of the exempting from this consideration of either having meeting some sort of application process or a, you know, timeline requirement related to coming back in a administrative position that requires Senate, that I know that came up, as I recall, a little bit more on the Senate side back in 2007. And I told some of the senators then that if, you know, they wanted to kind of try to tackle that in the bill, you know, I would kind of think about it. They didn't at the time. It's coming up now. But having thought about it then, I see the logic of this provision in 3671 in terms of when that happens, you know, there's a political element to it. And, you know, people are going to potentially take their lumps, you know, if they either are that appointee or they make that appointment. But there is, it seems like there is a certain amount of leeway that needs to be given to somebody to pull together the team that they want. So, I mean, I kind of, so that's, I think those two, regardless of what, you know, features of these two bills move forward, I do think that those, the section one, I don't know what it is, the B, A and B on the, well, I'll do it by line number, the 6, 7, and 8 lines on the second page, or on the third page, excuse me.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you. Janice and I went through such an interesting time during the ethics, interim ethics meeting that we have had endless discussions about this. And frankly, on the record, I was opposed to the revolving door legislation from the get-go simply because it gets us in these kind of binds. What's good for one or the other? You can't legislate these kinds of things. And it is a perception problem, not a real problem. But it's perceived by the public as a real problem, and I would say that we're right back there in an area where the public has perceived a problem. And I'm kind of like the fact that if mirroring language makes a lot of sense. Janice, would you respond to me about Ms. Lucas's comments about the word advertising and what that means? She rang my bell on that. What does that mean in the other bill? How would we, I mean, what kind of rulemaking could you do around that? Because I'm not wild about the language in there either, in terms of, because it's real clear if you're registered as a lobbyist, you're a lobbyist. But there's an awful lot of positions within state government that have a huge impact and are relationship driven, and how do you get at that?
Representative Berger, I guess two things. One is, I think, you know, in terms of like the mirroring, I think I don't see the mirroring exactly in 36-38 because it doesn't, you know, factor in that lobbying. But in terms of the advertising, again, that's why, you know, that kind of concern about this application process is why, you know, if you're going to apply it, to kind of use the time standard and not get into, you know, these kinds of details. At the same time, when I saw advertising, I guess I was assuming, and this, you know, assumptions are tricky, so I think it's a very, very good thing to kind of follow up on. Yep. But I guess I'm assuming that there's some, you know, somewhat standard job posting procedures. But obviously, this question is, you know, I think you would have to have somebody from DAS or somewhere come in and find that out. Is, you know, it is advertising in this kind of context mapped out somewhere? And I would not be surprised if it's not. But again, so then that gets into then, you know, if you were going to kind of go down this 1 year kind of deal, you know, stick with that approach. And
if yes. If I could speak to that, yeah, we do have certain procedures, but I would say that in certain high-profile cases, there's question in the public's mind if that was adequately done, and that's what brings us here, mm-hmm. I believe. Thank you.
Any other questions for either of these two people? And I want to thank both of you, because from my perspective, I've been playing both these in my mind and trying to figure out how do I meld them together. I want to say that I appreciate Representative Hanna. I think the catch on the judicial, which when you look at the deal, it doesn't say much, but it references all those governments, and that includes all of those people. So finding that one makes no sense. I mean, there are people who are attorneys here who have been doing a good job who would be good. Your comment, Janice, today on the issue that if a governor gets elected, and say it's a new governor, and all of a sudden he looks around for where is his talent pool to put some people together to make a cabinet, or kind of people he wants, a number of them, maybe, especially if it's from a different party, maybe the legislative people who have been there working with them all along, to not have not having the ability to bring your own people in would be really tough on a newly elected executive. And your comments also on the fact that once we get into this, it's a circle thing, is very true. So I will continue to work, and I personally will talk with Representative Hanna and see if there's anything else. But I appreciate both of your testimonies, because a couple of I absolutely agree on there better be a definition of what some of these things are, because I can see how bad that can go quickly. So thank you both. And committee, thank you. We're going to close our hearings on House Bill 3638 and 3671, and we're going to carry both of them over. And we'll see if we have. And again, I appreciate the work that everybody's done. Is there any other questions for the committee? Yes. Oh, well, let's put them down for public hearing and possible discussion.
Two different bills.
So we can go through public hearing quickly if you need to. With that,
okay. We
will close our Rules Committee for the 8th. Thank you all.